Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How large is China's claim on the planet's arable land, water, fossil fuels, and commodities? And should we be worried about how fast those shares are growing? Since the early 1980s, Chinese leaders have worked systematically to secure the raw materials necessary to transform and supercharge its economy, reaching far beyond its own borders to line up supply. But is China's gain the rest of the world's loss? And what will be the long-term consequences of rapid Chinese development on finances and living conditions in the rest of the world? International economist Dambisa Moyo is author of the new book, Winner Take All, China's Race for Resources and What It Means for the World. Dambisa, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We should stress here that this book is not only about China's impact on the future world. Talk for a minute about how global patterns of supply and demand are already changing.
Yes, so the basic premise of the book is about what China's doing, but in order to really give an accurate description of her campaign, which is incredibly extensive both across different countries, different regions, but also different types of commodities, I thought it was very important to set this against a backdrop of where supply and demand dynamics are in the commodity space. So on the demand side, there are obviously pressures emanating from the increase in population growth. We're now over 7 billion people in the world, with over 90% of the world's population living in the emerging world. We are also seeing incredible pressures emanating from wealth increases. Expectations are now that we will have an additional 3 billion people on the planet, many of them coming again from the developing world, who will be in the world's middle class by 2020. And then finally, there's a lot of pressure coming from the vast policies or increasing policies around urbanization. China in particular, the political class in China in particular, has got very, very clearly defined policies that will see as many as 200 cities, over 200 cities that will have a million people each. If you look at the United States today, you have about only 9 cities that have a million people each. So you can imagine very extensive pressures on increasing the urbanization. And all these three dynamics, population, wealth, and urbanization, putting a lot of pressure on demand of the supply and against this, the supply of arable land, water, energy, and minerals, which are all finite, depleting, and very, 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 very depleting resources across the world.
What's the situation within China in terms of natural resources that exist within its borders, and which ones really have to be sought from elsewhere?
So there are lots of different commodity resources that China needs because of her vast population. There's a population of about 1.3 billion people, of which 300 million live like us, if you will. So this is at the levels of living standards that you would see in the United States. But just to give you a bit of flavor of some of the dynamics, the United States, of 85 million barrels of oil that are consumed in the planet every day, the United States is the largest consumer, with about 22% of oil that's consumed by the U.S. By contrast, China consumes just around 10% of the world's oil needs. But if you flip it and you look at copper, for example, the United States, with a population of around over 300 million people, is consuming just around 10% of copper, but China is consuming almost 40% of copper. And copper is one of the big commodities that we see where China has lots of gaps. The difference between the supply of copper versus her demand of copper is very significant. And if you look across the world, copper is one of the assets where China has had a very aggressive campaign to secure these resources.
And of course, copper is a completely finite resource. I mean, it can be recycled, but there is only so much in existence on the planet.
That's exactly right. And there's lots of discussion now about substitutes, and you know, I'm sure we'll get into that more generally, but you know, there's lots of conversation around the use of aluminium as a substitute for copper. By most of the research that I've read and talking to a lot of traders and a lot of producers and users of copper and aluminium, basically only 20% of copper can be replaced by aluminium. So actually there is still very significant shortage and very significant gap, demand-supply gap on the copper needs.
So Dambisa, talk a little bit about how this plan to secure and control resources came into existence within China and how leaders there began to make decisions about what was most important to acquire and how to go about doing that.
So I think the thing that is particularly admirable and perhaps doesn't get enough respect or acknowledgement is the fact that this is a very systematic and deliberate approach by the Chinese political class. And I think if you contrast what China has been doing with other countries, the really interesting thing is that they are adopting a very friendly approach. So if you travel, as I've been fortunate enough to do, over 50 countries around the world, you'll find that by and large, the sentiment around the Chinese forays into these different countries from South America, across Africa, across Asia and Eastern Europe, but also in more developed regions such as Canada and Australia, people's sentiment is pretty open, pretty positive. These particular regions in the emerging world have very large pockets of poor, but also very large pockets of young people. 60 to 70% of the populations in these countries are under the age of 24, and they need jobs, they need trade, they need investment, and the Chinese are offering that. But I will say also that the real key aspect of this campaign for resource security from the Chinese really started in 2004, 2005 with their going out strategy, which is a very deliberate approach, deliberate strategy that was designed by the Chinese political class to basically not only secure resources, which, of course, could be a very serious constraint on their own economic growth, but also to very deliberately approach it in a very friendly manner.
And one of the ways they do this in a friendly manner is not necessarily always pushing for the absolute bottom price that they can pay.
That's right. And, you know, in the context of the book, I basically argue that there are three key pillars of the Chinese approach. The first part is this idea of symbiosis, which I've just touched upon. They're giving these countries exactly what they need. They need trade, they need investments, they need job creation. And the Chinese are happy to do that. And they are not only doing that, but they're also building infrastructure, roads, railways, and ports in many places around the world that desperately need the infrastructure. But the second key aspect is what one you've just touched upon, in the sense that they're able to use the vast amount of resources that the Chinese government has accumulated over many decades. They're sitting on $3 trillion of foreign exchange reserves, and they're able to draw on their resources to pay, and some people would actually argue overpay for assets, and therefore, if you will, annihilating the competition. In that sense, they don't have any competition in terms of their ability to pay. And then the last point is really that they've become what in economics we call a monopsonist price setter. So by that, it's the go-to price setter, the person or the entity that is able to set market prices, even in a competitive market. And this is really interesting because if you think about copper or coal, these are publicly traded markets where there are lots of different agents and traders who are competing for, you know, to buy and sell copper and coal. But already many traders are arguing now that China is the marginal price setter and in that sense is the one who determines what the price will be for these commodities. So very clearly three key aspects, the symbiosis, this idea of having deep pockets and therefore able to overpay, if you will, and then this idea of being a monopsonist, three very key pillars of the Chinese approach.
And it's interesting because they can overpay and yet they are a monopsonist and they're setting the prices. And in some ways they can operate almost like a sort of global Walmart. They order the most and so they decide how much things cost.
I've never thought of it like that, but I think you're right in many ways. And I think that, again, rather than bullying different countries into this position, they've done it in a very friendly way in which many countries, and if you look at surveys of which, you know, I can cite many examples, surveys of people's sentiment and views of the Chinese, you know, very, very positive, you know, and believing in the need for China to invest. I might point out here that it's not to say that there aren't any skirmishes or issues around investment process. Of course, there are some difficulties every now and again, but I think by and large, The sentiment around the Chinese engagement is very much a positive one. And they also are very welcomed because they don't tend to dictate what they think is the appropriate political infrastructure that should be governing a different country.
To the extent that the Chinese are building infrastructure, particularly in countries in the developing world where they're doing business, what role does Chinese labor play in that infrastructure?
Much less than people make it out to be. Of course, there are numerous examples or lots of journalistic pieces that I see where there are claims that Chinese labor is being used. And I can't say, and we're categorically that the number is zero. But I think that if you spend time on the ground, on the road, as I have, as I mentioned, I've been fortunate enough to go to over 50 countries around the world, it's not the case that there's a systematic approach to either abuse local workers or to flood these markets with Chinese workers. And even if it were the case, which I strongly believe it is not the case, I think that it's really incumbent on the local governments of these countries to redress those types of problems, whether it's in the labor markets or in the environmental concerns. And I think it's here where there's a lot of misinformation, accusations of the use of prisoners. I mean, as I say in my book, we're living in a camera-ready mobile phone world. You would think that there'd be much more evidence, and what I found is that there tends to be a lot of claims around what China is doing and not enough evidence.
How would you characterize China's stewardship of the resources it wants to control in terms of, say, environmentally sustainable practices?
So this is a very difficult question because I think that we all would love to live in a free world where the environmental concerns are taken, taken seriously and managed appropriately. And I think that's the world we ought to all aspire to. But I think it's really worth being a bit more sensible and sensitive about what exactly China is trying to do. As I mentioned earlier, they have 1.3 billion people, a billion who live in dire poverty. They are trying to do something that no one else in the history of the world has been able to do, which is to move hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And it's a political imperative for them. And so in the context of their policies and their approach to economic development, there are trade-offs. And in this particular instance, and many other governments do trade-off short-term benefits of economic improvements and reductions in poverty for environmental concerns. It's not always going to be that way. And, of course, lots of strides have been made to try and redress these issues. For example, China is very big now in the use of solar power. Beijing has got more solar panels in use than anywhere else in the world. They are leaders in desalination. They are trying to do the best that they can with the hand that they've been dealt. And I think rather than being so critical, which is one of the things that the international community loves to do when dealing with China, I think we need to be a bit more sympathetic about the challenge that they're trying to meet and try and help them to meet these challenges in a sort of green growth approach, because obviously environmental concerns and the ability to continue to grow as an economy does matter, is hitched very significantly on whether or not you have environmental policies in place. But I think to constantly berate them and to constantly be negative about what they've done, I think doesn't really help the more fundamental situation.
It also ignores the realities of the Industrial Revolution in the West, which certainly created a lot of environmental problems that later were approached to varying degrees.
Exactly. I think we're just impatient, and I understand that. I myself was born and raised in Africa, so I know we're incredibly impatient. We want to see political reforms. We want to see economic reforms. We want to see environmental, human rights, and labor rights adhered to. And I think we will get there. But I think the point is we need to be on side with what China is trying to do. And besides, in just a few years, they will be the largest economy in the world. And, at that point, I think there'll be many more countries that will be interested in what China's done over what other countries have done.
International economist Dambisa Moyo is my guest. We're talking this hour about her book, Winner Take All, China's Race for Resources and What It Means for the World. We'd love your input and your questions on this conversation. If you'd like to call us, the number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is international economist Dambisa Moyo. Her new book is called Winner Take All, China's Race for Resources and What It Means for the World. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Dambisa, in terms of feeding this very large Chinese population with a combination of both domestically produced food and imported food, there's a difference between simply buying food from abroad and trying to control arable land abroad to produce that food. Can you talk about why China feels it's important to control the production of some of this food it will import?
So that's a great question. And again, I think it's really important for us to set the answer in context. Population of China, as I mentioned again, 1.3 billion, but it only has 7% arable land. And by arable land, I mean land upon which we can grow crops and actually provide food for not just plants, but also for other animals. And remember that most of the cities that are built, not just in China, but around the world, tend to be built on arable land. So they've got, because of their urbanization program, they have a situation where they're having less and less access to arable land. You go to a place like Africa, and the continent of Africa now has the largest amount of untilled arable land left on the planet. So it's a natural process, you would imagine, that China, with a large population, very little arable land, would be looking to go and engage in deals and actually really help out in the agriculture produce of Africa by engaging in deals with these economies. It's worth, again, stressing that a place like Africa with a billion in population has it represents less than 2% of world trade. And this is even though this economy, African economy, and I'm taking it as a whole, even though there are numerous countries there, has, you know, is able to be the largest producer or the untilled arable land on the planet. So it's those types of dislocations that China is taking advantage of. And again, I think there are benefits on both sides to be had. And it's a great pity that Africa has lagged behind. It should be a much more prominent agriculture producer, but because of subsidy programs such as the farm subsidy bill here in the United States, but also the common agriculture policy in the across Europe, which has basically protected local farmers at the disadvantage of African farmers, you see now that African governments are very rationally and reasonably looking to China as a partner for crops and for production of agricultural goods.
Is water infrastructure one of the major contributions that China is making on the continent of Africa?
Well, I think that the water issue is much more sensitive for them at home. And water obviously is quite difficult to transport. There are issues of already in China. There are already skirmishes between China and India and the Brahmaputra River. The Chinese have been trying to reroute that. But they're also trying to reroute rivers within their own economy to satiate a lot of demand for fresh water. But as I also mentioned earlier, one of the things where China is a leader in the world is around desalination. The world has 70% or is covered by 70% water, but less than 1% of that water is actually fresh water that we can even use for drinking or sanitation. And because, again, of the massive population and the significant pressures that the demands for industrialization are placing on the Chinese government, they have invested significantly in R&D and in desalination to try and address the water concerns.
What will be the global repercussions of China's growing appetite for beef?
Well, I think it's not just about beef. I have in the book some very specific estimates on what the implication of their population converging to Western standards of living might look like. And you know, rather than go into grave detail around what those numbers are, I mean, I would hope and I'd urge people to have a look at the book because I think they're quite interesting. But, you know, we've said this already. You've got 300 million Americans living at a certain standard of living. You're asking 1.3 billion Chinese to live at that level, or they now expect to live at that level, never mind everybody else living in the rest of the emerging world. And, of course, there's significant pressures, not just on the superficially things like wheat and the production of cows, but there are also hidden costs in the amount of water that is required as an input for the production of beef. But more generally, I think there are two things that are worth stressing around why and how China's commodity pressures could lead to more dislocations in the world. First of all, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, so since 2009, we've seen commodity prices rise by over 150%, significant spikes in commodity prices, and some of them are because of more tactical short-term things such as the droughts that are going on in the U.S. right now. But a lot of these factors are more fundamental, which I talked about earlier, which is around population growth, issues around wealth increases and urbanization. But there's another aspect which is even more disheartening, and that's in the last decade we've seen over 20 wars around the world and conflicts that have their origins around commodity scarcity. And if you look at some of the reports coming out of the U.S. government and other places, the forecasts are that we will see significantly more wars and clashes around the world that have their origins in commodities. And it's these sort of things that I think are very, very pertinent and should be on the front burner in terms of international discourse.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jan in Denton. Hi, Jan.
Hi. My question is about China's occupation or settlization of Tibet, about the mineral and gem resources that are in the Tibetan plateau. I was recently there, and you could see huge road infrastructure building going on, a changing landscape, and another question is about Vietnam and the islands off the Philippines, how China is trying to possess that part of the ocean. And I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks for your call.
So thanks very much for that question. And I should actually state up front that I'm an economist and not a political scientist. And by that, I mean a lot of my comments were really about the dislocations that we as economists look at and what the implications would be for prices. So my knowledge and my ability to speak authoritatively around issues on the political sphere, which is what you're touching on here, is quite limited. I will say, however, that one of the things that continues to occupy a lot of my research and my thinking is around the fact that by 2020, most forecasts suggest that China, which is a non-democratic state and uses state capitalism, will be the leading economy in the world as compared to the United States, which is democratic and has private capitalism. I think we are living in very interesting times because the number one and number two countries are very different in their political and economic approaches. And yet, I think there's not enough discussion about the fact that when China, and I say when because I think it will be a very big surprise to most economists if China does not make it by 2020 to be the largest economy. But when that happens, and China is the largest economy, there will be many, many countries around the world, policymakers, particularly in the emerging markets, and a lot of people also, billions of people living in the emerging markets, close to 5 billion people, who will be looking at China's model politically and economically and will be trying to replicate that model in order to reduce poverty and increase economic growth at home. I think there's far too much emphasis or expectation that somehow China is going to convert and converge to Western policies around economics and politics, and not enough attention is paid to the fact that more and more, without more proof and more emphasis, that there's a higher likelihood that the rest of the world will start to converge and begin to look much more like the way China does today. And this is not to say that we don't want freedoms and people don't want democracy. I just think that people's appetite for a more organically derived democracy will increase as people around the world, particularly young populations, become more impatient on the lack of economic growth in their economies. So it's a long-winded way of answering your question, which is that if you live in a world where there's a lot of poverty, I would say that people tend to prioritize their economic freedoms over their political freedoms, and there'd be much more pressure in that direction over the next decade.
Well, is it economically feasible, though, WSF, for the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, to continue to direct this acquisition of resources? Or at some point, will they have to transition control of these activities to private entities?
Well, there clearly are deadweight losses to the approach where, you know, the government is involved very heavily and they are steering the state-owned enterprises. Of course, there are clearly losses to the economy. But if you look again at some of the more objective measures, let's take the measure of a Gini coefficient, G-I-N-I, which Gini coefficients are measures of income inequality, which economists focus on. If you look at the Gini coefficient of the U.S. and China, they're almost identical. These are the kind of things that people don't spend enough time thinking about. You have, as I mentioned earlier, you've got the United States, democratic, private capitalism. You've got China, it's non-democratic, state capitalism. And they've got the same degree of income inequality. So people around the world are really spending their time asking the question, which model is better? Do we want to live in America where the income inequality is as bad as living in China where there is no democracy and there is no there is more state capitalism and not private capitalism? So these are the questions we ought to be asking. And I would say that over the long term, I don't believe that the Chinese model of state capitalism can work. But clearly, if you look at the private capitalism in the United States, there are many who would argue that that also has not worked in the way that we would like to see over many decades. So the question is, how long can China's government continue with state capitalism and a lack of democracy as we see it? And I would say that they've still got a lot of road room to go yet.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Paul on the line now in Novato, California. Hi, Paul. Paul, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Go right ahead, please. Do you have a question?
Yes. The question of resources of the world. It seems to me that there's one resource that's unlimited, which is solar, and that right now the world is on the verge of being able to convert enough solar energy to run every electric train system from solar. Germany is approaching, I think, up to 25% solar powered now, and they plan to shut down all their nukes in, 2022, when they claim they will have enough solar energy to do it. So, and the way they're doing it is a policy called the feed-in tariff. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it pays homeowners to harvest solar energy and feed it onto the grid, and they pay them 54 cents a kilowatt hour. So farmers in Germany are making $60,000 a year just harvesting solar. And it seems if we go in that direction, then we're not fighting with each other over resources.
Well, Dambisa, to what extent is solar power part of China's long-term energy planning?
So I think to the extent that there are a range of solutions, that's a good thing. We should be trying everything to avert price spikes that we've seen already and I think we'll continue to see, but also to avert conflict. But I'm sitting in New York today, and it's a pretty dark day here, and I cannot imagine a situation where a whole country or even just the city could be relying on solar energy to actually power the economy here. So as much as I am optimistic that there are a whole range of other sources of energy, some of them perhaps we haven't even thought about yet, I am perhaps less sanguine than something like that solar energy could be the panacea for all our energy woes. I think that it's going to have to be some kind of a melange or a mix of many different sources of energy, whether it's natural gas, whether, dare I say it, some nuclear, which is what the French are relying on quite considerably, but also some of the sort of more environmentally friendly ones, such as windmills and so on. I think the question is still out there, and we need to be open-minded. Specifically where China is concerned, though, again, they are leading in solar energy. As I mentioned to you earlier, they are, you know, Beijing has more solar panels in use than anywhere else in the world. And I think, you know, it's partly to do with the question that came up earlier, you know, this idea of the trade-off between environmental concerns and being able to deliver economic growth and reduce poverty. But it's also about efficiencies. How are we going to be able to power these economies very significant economies without being able to rely on these depleting and finite resources that we, that fossil fuels that we've become so accustomed to. So I think it is important to keep an open mind, but I think it's also important to be realistic about what people are trying to achieve here. As I mentioned earlier, 85 million barrels of oil consumed every day, 20%, by far the largest amount is consumed here in the United States. If everyone around the world consumed at the level of the United States, it would simply be impossible to keep things going. And you know, the United States has had to make some deals, if you will, with the deals with the devil in order to maintain this level. As you know, the United States has engaged and continues to engage with many countries that don't hold the same standards of human rights and a democratic process in order to keep energy consumption at these levels. And the question, I think, for Americans is that something that America wants to stand for? And, I think fundamentally we need to be open-minded.
That's an interesting point, because people are quick to jump on China as being willing to sort of make deals with potentially corrupt governments without strings attached. But you're saying the United States has done the same thing in certain cases.
Well, once again, if I point to the 85 million barrels of consumption a day, the United States, the largest consumer with 20%, the largest producers of energy are Saudi Arabia and Russia. And I think by most accounts and most measures, if you look at Transparency International, for example, or some of the Freedom House indicators, I think it's pretty clear that these are countries that are deemed non-democratic and with a lot of corruption. And yet the United States does not seem to have a problem when engaging with those economies. But we all, you know, our heckles are raised when we talk about China and China's engagement around the world.
Why have other sort of legacy economic powers like the United States, like the developed West, not moved as aggressively as China to secure their access to non-energy related resources into the future?
Well, I think it's not that they haven't done anything. I think, to be clear, the distinction is more that places like the U.S. and across much of Europe have kind of had a bit of a lazy muscle, if I may use that term. These are developed economies. They need to get access to energy as quickly as possible. And we do have a lazy muscle, because we know that fossil fuels work. We know that they are available. And even though there have been numerous calls, whether it's the Malthusian concerns of the Club of Rome in the 70s or issues around peak oil, there have been many times that people have claimed and been concerned about depleting resources and over demand. And we seem to have been bailed out by technology. I mean, my concern
Let me jump in. We need to take a break. I'll have you finish in just a moment. My guest is economist Dambisa Moyo. Her new book is called Winner Take All, China's Race for Resources and What It Means for the World.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with international economist Dambisa Moyo, author of the new book Winner Take All, China's Race for Resources and What It Means for the World. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. And Dambisa, before the break, you were explaining that it is not that other countries in the world have not tried to secure resources into the future, but that with regard at least to fuel, it has been easy to sort of do business as usual.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that also the approach has tended to be quite unilateral in nature, which is why it's problematic. And by unilateral, I mean countries are very much focused on what's in it for me, what's in it for my population. And you could argue even that the political process in these different economies actually means that governments don't really care that much about what the implications are for other regions of the world. But in the case of China, which is why I think it's so incredibly clever what they've done, they actually have to rely on what they're doing elsewhere. Otherwise, they won't be able to secure them. They're not interested in a military campaign, as we've seen elsewhere. And military incursions have not been part of their approach. And I think that in terms of looking ahead to the world and the way the world works, we should be aspiring to a time when there's less conflict and commodity prices are at a much more affordable place. And I think that much more multilateralism and cooperation and discussion at the international level will actually help us get there faster than these sort of every nation for itself type of approach, aggressive approaches that we've seen elsewhere.
We have an email here from Sam who writes, the colonial period in Africa was marked by a lot of looting of African resources, including labor. The biggest hole was the lack of firm institutions and the use of corruptive tactics like bribing government officials and divide and rule tactics. How different is China's approach regarding corruption, building lasting institutions, and indoctrination to communism?
So I don't believe that there's anything or any approach, any aspect of the Chinese approach that has any colonialistic interests. The colonialists were interested, in largely two things. One was political infrastructure, so the change and transfer of politics, and secondly, the religious aspects. And on those two points, the Chinese have absolutely no interest. In fact, one of the bigger criticisms is that perhaps they don't care enough about the political infrastructure that they find when they get to these places. Now, this is not to say that the colonial era didn't have any economic agenda, and of course it did, but even then, it's a very, very different approach from the economic agenda of the Chinese. As I said, if you go to many places across the world, in Africa, South America, people on the ground actually like the Chinese. They look at the Chinese, they say, look, these guys are not coming to preach to us about democracy or how our governments are so bad, and yet they're dealing with them anyway. They're coming here to do business, and we need that business. And, you know, just to illustrate, there was a fantastic survey that came out a few years ago, the Pew survey. Pew Research Institute did a survey on the Chinese, impressions of the Chinese in Africa. They went to about 10 countries in Africa, and they asked the Africans, what do you think of the Chinese? Do you like them? Do you hate them? Are they better than the Americans? And by wide margins, I'm talking 98%, 97%, the Africans said, yes, we like the Chinese. They're better than the Americans. They're improving our livelihoods, and they're creating jobs and building infrastructure. And I think that there's a message in there that, you know, the Chinese are not perfect. And as I said, there are lots of skirmishes and lots of issues. But I think one of the things that has become very clear as our populations around the emerging world have burgeoned and become the younger populations have become so large, is we've got to come up with solutions that actually work. The problem with the Western approach over the last 50 years is that it's been heavily and over-reliant on aid. So this whole notion of pity, looking at places like South America and Africa as destinations for charity, and not engaging these economies as being part of the global economy. It's to the detriment of those economies. But, you know, people's patience has run out. And this is why just here next door to the United States, Brazil, places like Colombia now have China as their largest trading partner, their largest investor. It should be the United States. But I think there's far too much of a negative impression of these places as a destination for investment, and it ultimately will hurt the U.S. if the U.S. doesn't change its stance and approach, and understand that people want to live like Americans, and part of that process is making sure that there's trade and there's engagement on a fair level.
Do China's goals extend beyond simply providing for its own population into the future so that ultimately they control the supply of commodities available for export to the rest of the world?
You know, I hear these types of comments every now and then. I just, you know, having spent time with a number of Chinese policymakers, they just have absolutely no interest in that right now. I mean, I will give you an example. I come from a country, very small country in Africa. It's got about 10 million people. You know, we have failed just for 10 million people to deliver economic growth. This is less than the population of New York. It's less than the population of a city in China. And we failed to create economic growth and reduce poverty in a meaningful way. We're asking the Chinese to deliver economic growth and to avert a political crisis in their country by moving a billion people out of poverty. Thus far, they've moved 300 million out of poverty in a very short span of time. I don't think it's very easy for people to understand how difficult the challenge that they have at home is. But, you know, on that basis, they have absolutely no interest whatsoever. And why would they foray out and, you know, forge or go out into the rest of the world to try and conquer or you know, use commodities as a tool. I mean, their primary goal is to stem any political problem at home. And part of that is by delivering economic growth and reducing poverty, as they've done so successfully over the last 30 years. So I'm not sympathetic at all. Now, there may come a time, you know, decades, centuries from now, where China has satiated itself and maybe becomes much more like the United States, where the average person is doing well, living a decent lifestyle compared to elsewhere in the world. And then maybe at that time, they might change their stance. But for now and for the foreseeable future, I think they've got enough on their hands at home.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phones, we have Sam calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Sam.
Hey.
Hi, go right ahead.
All right. Well, I just returned from Tokyo, and one big problem on everyone's mind in the Japanese islands is the falling population. In Tokyo, the population is falling really rapidly, and people are concerned that it will affect economic performance well into the future. And I understand that China's population recently peaked. And so my question is whether or not China can transition into sort of a post-industrial economic model before this falling population begins to affect its economic performance. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts on population, its effect on China's economy, and whether or not China has any solutions, maybe immigration in the future. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
So that's a really great question. I think that, again, just to set this China question in the context of the world, we are living in a very, very unique period of the world in terms of population growth. From 1960 to today, we've seen this massive explosion in population growth, and most demographers would say it's something that was never seen in history or prehistory. And actually, after it tapers off around 2100 at around 10 billion people, we will never see it again. So this is a very, very unique situation. Having said that, the world, we expect now that the world population will be at around 9 billion population by 2050. Still, China's population is tapering off, but still increasing, but at a slower rate. I mean, some of the bigger concerns are places like India, where we have a population increasing at 1 million people per month. So every month they've got a new million people added to their population. So significant population pressures from elsewhere in the world. I do think that because you have a stock, there's a difference between a stock and a flow. So in this case, even though the flow has tapered off, so you're not increasing as rapidly as you have in the past, you still have a stock of a population, a large population of people that will still put a lot of demand pressures on the different range of commodities from arable land, water, energy, and minerals. And so I think that will continue. With regards to the Chinese policymakers changing their stance in terms of immigration and so on, I mean, it's actually, there has been, if you go to places like Shanghai or Guangzhou, even in Beijing, you can see that they have opened up to immigration, perhaps not as aggressively as you see in the United States. But I don't think this is going to be a key agenda point in terms of their population pressure and population dynamics, certainly not for the foreseeable few decades, because I think, again, their most important and pressing matter is to deliver for the population that they have right now that continues to be incredibly poor. It's worth stressing, there are more poor people in China than there are in Africa, more poor people in India than there are in Africa. And this is something that people don't seem to understand. There's so much negativity around what's going on in Africa. I mean, I'm always shocked as an African to see how badly and negatively Africans are portrayed. But you can see that if you contrast that with the way China is portrayed, which, by the way, is the largest lender to the United States today, United States government, you can see that there's a different tone, and people's expectations, certainly in China itself, are that the Chinese government is very focused on delivering economic growth and continuing to reduce poverty in its population.
How successful has China been thus far in growing domestic demand for the products it controls and produces?
Yeah, so again, a very, very key pillar of their policy. In 2010, the Chinese government released their most recent five-year plan. I'm sure your listeners will be familiar that every 5 years, the Chinese government puts out a plan for what they call a five-year plan, and they basically outline what they think is the most important aspects of the economy that they would like to engage in and to improve. And some of the aspects of their of that policy in 2010 were around education and healthcare, but also very keen and very significant was that the Chinese government was very interested in developing domestic demand. Consumption in China is about 35% of GDP. If you compare that with the United States, where 70% of GDP is consumption, you can see that there's a massive gap, and probably both are too far at extremes. In that sense, I think the U.S. could probably use go some way to reduce the amount of consumption share of GDP, and perhaps China should increase a little bit, probably closer to 50% is the number that most economists would agree upon. And I think that that is definitely a big part of their of the strategy in China. They're very focused on domestic demand. Again, I think many people listening who are interested in China will know that China has spent the last several decades very heavily dependent on export industry. Now the government is really focused on trying to develop its own economy at home, as well as keeping the exports going. And part of that is domestic demand and really pushing for consumption. And they're doing that by lots of different tools, such as issues around subsidies, removing subsidies on education and healthcare, but also other sort of programs in terms of to stimulate the economy. So very much a key part of the government's agenda.
What are the biggest concerns within China as to the problems that could threaten this ongoing expansion and securing of resources? I mean, is internal unrest a serious concern, the potential for that?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, internal concern is a big issue for any country. Whether it's in a democratic society like the United States, you know, we've seen the Tea Party, we've seen Occupy Wall Street, we've seen many different campaigns emerge. But, you know, of course, in an emerging market where the majority of your population is desperately poor, these are obviously concerns that are very destabilizing and also can be very, very harmful in terms of the operation of a country. Look at what's happened across North Africa and the Middle East in the past several years. People, a lot of people, particularly Western commentators, have tended to say, oh, that's just a problem that's associated with political infrastructure and people wanting democracy. As somebody who was born and raised in Africa, I actually don't think it has much to do with political infrastructure. It's much more to do with economics. People want to see their livelihoods improve. And this is a problem that the Chinese government and governments all across the emerging world are facing and will continue to face more aggressively as the world has become more integrated. You know, you go to places in Africa, people are on Facebook. They see how people in Brazil are living. They see how people in China are living. And they want to see improvements in their livelihoods as soon as possible. The biggest constraint that the Chinese government has now, and they have said it explicitly, and in the book I give some quotes from Minister Zhu, who is the Minister of Environment and Natural Resources, the biggest constraint facing China today is the constraint of natural resources. There's simply not enough resources as we have today on the planet to meet the demands, not just of China, but of the global population.
Dambisa Moyo is an international economist and author of the new book, Winner Take All, China's Race for Resources and What It Means for the World. Dambisa, it's been a very interesting conversation. Thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions for the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.